Are plants and humans anything alike in terms of metabolism? How can we learn from plant metabolism to create more sustainable chemistry? And how does one end up driving the development of one of the most popular open source softwares in metabolomics? In this episode, Tomasz Pluskal answers all of these questions and more as we discuss his work and its impact on research in health. Welcome to Season 4 of the Metabolomist Podcast, where we explore the transformative role of metabolomics and multiomics in advancing the principles of 5P medicine. That is predictive, preventive, precision, population-based, and participatory medicine. I am your host, Alice Limonciel, and this year I will engage with leading scientists and entrepreneurs to uncover how integrative omics strategies are set to revolutionize medical research and also patient care. Join us as we delve into the latest innovations and challenges at the intersection of metabolomics and 5P medicine, shaping the future of research in health. Welcome to this episode of The Metabolomist. Today, my guest is Tomasz Pluskal. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me in this discussion. I'm excited about the several topics that we discussed today. We wanted to talk about software development because you're involved in the development of an open source software for mass spectrometry data processing that is very well used and well known by the community. And we'll also discuss your work in the field of plant metabolomics. And as your junior group leader at the Institute of Organic Chemistry and Biochemistry of the Czech Academy of Sciences in Prague, right?
Yes.
And can you tell us a little bit more about your work there and also what got you to that field?
What got me to this field, that's going to be a longer story. I originally studied computer science, and when I was finishing my studies, I thought my career was pretty much lined up, that I would be working as a software developer in some big company, but I didn't feel quite ready to do that. I was like 23 years old, you know, I wanted a little bit of adventure. And I was really interested in Japanese culture since childhood. And I was also doing Japanese martial arts, karate specifically. Mm-hmm. And so I was looking for some opportunity how to get to Japan for at least like a year so I could get some feeling for the country. And eventually, after a bit of searching, I found an opportunity, but the opportunity happened to be in a molecular biology lab. And so I started working in a molecular biology lab, and eventually that turned me into a biologist. So I started working with mass spec. I started developing metabolomics methodologies and workflows. And this is also where I started working on the MZMind project. So basically, building software was something that I knew how to do, whereas metabolomics, I didn't really know how to do. So this was my escape to do something that I was at least comfortable with.
And I escaped that ended up helping a lot of people.
I guess, yeah, it was quite a successful escape, yeah. And so I started working on metabolomics. At the time, we were working with yeast and studying primary metabolism, so very quantitative approach, trying to understand the differences in the metabolic pathways when the cells are dividing and non-dividing and different nutritional states and so on. So very kind of fundamental cell biology research. When I got my PhD, I ended up staying in Japan for 10 years, so it was a longer trip than I expected. And I eventually got my PhD in molecular biotechnology. And then after that, I went to do a postdoc in Boston in Jinka Wang's lab, where I got exposed to plant metabolism, like a completely different side of metabolism, where we look at the specialized metabolites, less quantitative, more qualitative, and especially looking at the biosynthesis. So looking at how the plants generate this amazing diversity of chemicals. And since I started my lab 5 years ago, I'm trying to combine this diverse expertise in different fields that I have and develop computational and experimental workflows to look at this amazing diversity of chemicals that we find in plants, but from a bit more high throughput and data-driven perspective.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, it's an amazing path. And if I get it right, you've shifted from mostly studying yeast to studying plants. And yes. And there you saw that difference in the metabolome between these different kingdoms, actually. What are the main differences? How would you describe these differences besides the diversity of classes of metabolites, for example?
I think it's also different questions that people ask. Mm-hmm. So when people study model organisms like yeast or even human cells, typically the approach is more quantitative. So they look at all the primary metabolites that are quite well described and the pathways are known. And they try to understand, okay, if you have this disease, the metabolic network changes in this way and you get more of these metabolites and less of these metabolites, or this pathway is activated and this pathway is downregulated. So these are the kind of questions that people study. Mm-hmm. Whereas when we look at the specialized metabolism, whether it's in plants or many people do this in microbes as well, bacteria especially, then the questions are a bit different in the sense that we don't really care so much how this specialized metabolism changes in different conditions or under different stimuli, but we are more interested in the diversity. So every species is producing a huge number of unique metabolites that you maybe only find in that species and no other species, mm-hmm. even the related species. Mm-hmm. And we want to understand this diversity. We want to map it. We want to understand where it comes from in terms of genes and enzymes. So it's different types of questions. And the diversity is really huge. You know, if you take a random plant from the garden and you run it on the mass spec, easily you can detect 20,000 signals there. So, and then you take another plant and you get 20,000 signals and maybe half of them are different from the first 20,000. So it's really a huge diversity and it's really an interesting field to be in because, yeah, maybe I just said traditionally the natural product chemistry was done in a very, very low throughput manner. You know, people mm-hmm. study one plant and they find some effect, some bioactivity. So they try to isolate the active substance. Mm-hmm. And eventually, after a lot of work, they isolate a molecule, which they solve the structure with NMR and they realize, okay, this is caffeine. And then it has amazing effects on humans. Mm-hmm. And that's great. Mm-hmm. And then they consider this plant is kind of dumb. You know, we isolated that one molecule and we've done with the species, but actually now we have the technology that we can look at this diversity and we can really look at what's in there in much more detail, much more resolution.
And do you also use the whole profile as a way to distinguish, like, does the whole profile drive you or do you still look at specific molecules?
This is also what people do. I mean, for crop development, as you mentioned, for example, we don't really do crop development in my lab. We are more looking at the unique chemicals that have not been studied yet. So our direction is a little bit different, but yes, people do this. Mm-hmm. People also use the chemical profiles to understand something about the species and the evolution of species. And it's quite interesting to see that the chemical diversity of a species does not correlate very well with the genetic kind of phylogeny. So mm-hmm. you would expect very related species have very similar metabolomes overall, mm-hmm. but actually they can be quite different. And I think it makes sense because maybe even subtle changes in the enzymatic networks can lead to huge changes in the downstream metabolites.
Interesting. And these changes you see, because, so of course, I'm making parallels with humans because I'm more used to the human situation. So when we see differences, so we also have this case where, especially when you look at chronic disease, you're only going to have a fraction of the risk to develop the disease that will be linked to genes. And a lot of it will come from environmental factors, which I guess are also very important for the development of plants and the metabolism of plants. So when you study plants, you have them in a very controlled environment, I guess, in your experiments most of the time. Maybe you work with wild plants, I don't know. But how do you separate those two aspects, the genetics and the environmental influence?
Yeah, we also work with wild plants, or they, uh-huh. and they're something I would call semi-wild. So like plants from botanical gardens, for example. I think what you described as the effect of the environment in humans, maybe the equivalent in plants would be the kind of evolutionary pressure. So it's not so much about the immediate environment where the plant is right now. It's more like the environment where this plant species has developed that mm-hmm. makes a lot of effect on the kind of specialized metabolites that it has evolved to produce to cope mm-hmm. with that environment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we do have these environmental effects, although on a slightly different time scale.
Yeah, and I think because of the goals you're aiming at with your work, you're not looking at extreme conditions like drought or like things that would put a hard pressure on the metabolome of the plants, but this is also somewhere where metabolomics will help in the broader field, right?
True, yeah. And sometimes we do look at various strange conditions when we want to stimulate the biosynthesis of some specialized mm-hmm. metabolites, because oftentimes these things are linked to stress. So we sometimes torture the plants in various ways so that we can see how they respond and what kind of metabolites they start producing.
Yeah. Now, often when I forget to water my plants, I often wonder what I'm doing to them, and I start to go in that direction as well, of like, how are they coping with the stress? I guess for you it must be much more intense because you know even more how they respond to that.
Yeah, I think plants, when you're interested in biosynthesis, typically the main approach people use to understand about the biosynthetic networks is correlating gene expression levels. So mm-hmm. you sequence the plant, and then you study gene expression across the different tissues or different conditions. Mm-hmm. And there is an assumption that genes that are involved in one pathway to produce one specialized metabolite tend to be correlated because they have some common regulatory elements. So their expression is correlated. And so when you identify one enzyme, then this helps you to identify the others because you look at the correlation of the expression.
Mm-hmm.
And for this, it's sometimes useful to torture the plants, because by that you induce different conditions that have different response in the expression levels of the genes. So you increase the power of your correlation analysis. Sometimes we use plant hormones. We treat the plants with the various hormones just to dysregulate their transcriptome. So then later when we analyze the transcriptome, we get more data for the correlation analysis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting. And I was looking at your website to understand a bit better the angles that you're taking in your research. And I really like the way you describe your work, that is to engineer novel nature-inspired chemistry using sustainable biosynthetic tools. And here I would like to ask you, what are those sustainable biosynthetic tools? Like, what is it that you work with specifically?
Well, maybe taken from a broader perspective, think about how we humans do chemistry, right? How we produce chemicals. And the chemicals can be anything. You know, let's take a look at drugs, for example, because those are very valuable chemicals. We start by digging some fossil materials like oil. We process that. We build some basic chemical building blocks. And then we do a lot of processing, you know, organic synthesis that we used to build larger chemicals from those building blocks. Mm-hmm. And that often requires a lot of energy, a lot of rare, expensive cofactors and so on. Mm-hmm. And it often produces a lot of waste. And now if you compare that to how nature does chemistry, for example, in plants, you know, they take all their energy from the sun, and there's plenty of sunshine available. They typically just use very basic building blocks, you know, like some nitrogen from the soil, some phosphate, some very basic elements. Mm-hmm. And they take carbon from the air, you know, which we have excess of. And then from that carbon, they build very amazing chemicals that sometimes human chemists cannot even reproduce. So the general approach is to try to do chemistry a bit more like nature does. And we can now do that if we engineer biosynthetic pathways into specialized microorganisms. Mm-hmm. Then you can feed the microorganisms essentially any nutrients, you know, you could feed them bio-waste. And then they will consume this bio-waste and produce those chemicals for us using the enzymatic systems that are inspired by nature. And then that way you can produce very rare and precious chemicals without doing any organic chemistry.
Mm-hmm. That sounds really great. And when we look at the paper, we're going to see a bit how you choose the enzymes to put into these organisms. But I will leave some mystery there for the moment, because before we get there, I would like to talk with you about EmsenMine, about the database that you've developed, because I think it's really a big asset for the community. And so that's one of the reasons why I was really happy to have you as a guest. So you told us already, like, this started as a kind of an escape from the less pleasant parts of your learning curve in metabolomics. Tell us more about, so maybe it started with you in front of your computer, but eventually it turned into a community. So can you tell us about that evolution?
I mean, actually, I have to say that I was not the person who started the MGMind project. It was originally started in Finland by Matteo Risit's group. But at some point, pretty early on, I sort of took over the project because the student who was working on it in Matteo's lab finished their PhD and then they were done. And for me, it was basically a necessity because I started working on metabolomics in Japan. Like I said, that was back in 2006. And that was the time the Orbitrap just came out. So we bought one of the first Orbitraps in Japan at the time. But there was no software to process the data from the Orbitrap. And it took the mass spec companies another 10 years until they started delivering software that was really capable of processing that high-resolution data. So I really wanted to look at my own data. And then I realized, okay, there's no software to do that. No sophisticated software, I mean. And I found MZMine and I started first contributing to it and then eventually rewriting it in a way that would allow us to process these high-resolution data sets from the Orbiter. And then I was using it myself. And of course, because it was already an open source project, I contributed all my improvements to the open source code base. And then eventually this led to the release of MZMine tool in 2010. And that's where things really took off. So this became hugely popular and attracted a huge community around it, not only community of users, but also many people who wanted to contribute new functions. So community of developers. And some of those developers became very active, and particularly a group of guys from Minster, starting with Robin Schmidt and then Ansgar Korf and Stefan Heikeroth. They did their PhD on MZMind, and that made a huge improvement. And so the project really was upgraded to yet another level that eventually culminated in the release of MZMind 3. And since then, the core developers, so the group of guys from Minster and then myself, decided to take this even further. And last year, we started a company that now continues to develop MZMine in a professional setting. So developing an enterprise version of MZMine that is tailored for the pharma and biotech industries and chemical industries that need this kind of software. And provides the level of support and kind of certification, let's say, that the professional customers expect.
Yeah, because as you said in the introduction of the project, often things get built, databases, software, and then when the PhD student goes away, they're not maintained. So this must be the biggest challenge. Maybe now it's flying on its own, but at the beginning, especially to keep it going.
It was a challenge. I think we were quite successful in the way that we made everything open, which allowed more people to come in and then gradually build up the community of developers. But it is true that overall, most of the actual code comes from maybe less than five people. Yeah. So even though there is a large community of people who contributed to MZMine, the core of the software was written by probably less than five people. And that's really the people who, you know, should take the credit for it. And those are the people that we started the company with eventually. And I think if this kind of open source academic software manages to survive and to develop into a commercial entity, that's a huge success. I'm very happy about it.
Yeah, thank you, Kasby. I'm wondering, especially with a large community like this for the open source software, how do you choose as a community which features you want to develop? Is there a kind of voting system or how does it work?
When MZMind was completely open source and academic, we essentially didn't care. So anything that somebody wanted to contribute, we would just put it in the software. And so the quality would vary. Some of the modules were very good and well tested and everybody was using them. And there was a lot of modules that were just, you know, barely usable or even unusable because somebody put the code together 10 years ago and then nobody really maintained it. And that's just the reality of the way it's done in academia. Now we try to do it in a very different way, of course, because now we're developing an enterprise software and that really needs to guarantee the quality of every module and everything has to have proper documentation and so on. So things are changing now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And can you tell us in a nutshell what part of the process is covered by the software? So you start from the raw spectra and then how far does it go in terms of supporting the understanding of the data?
Yeah, it's the main part has always been in processing the raw data. So turning the raw data, which if you think about it, is just millions and millions of numbers stored in a file that can be represented as some sort of spectra full of signals, but it's just digital data. Yeah. And we want to translate this into data that a biologist can take a look at and get some understanding from. So that means first turning all this spectral data into some sort of table of detected ions and their quantities and all the information we can get about the ions, like what kind of adduct it is, what chemical formula and so on. And then we can go further. We can do basic statistical analysis. We're not trying to develop a super comprehensive statistical analysis suite here, but basic statistical analysis, multivariate data analysis. And then we can go further, especially in terms of identification. MZMind now supports molecular networking, so we can do molecular networking directly in MZMind, visualize the molecular networks. We can look at fragmentation data and SMS spectra. There's a lot of tools for visualization and interpretation of SMS data, spectral library matching. And now we are also developing machine learning models for mass spectrometry in my lab. So these are more of the research-oriented projects. And we are trying to implement these models then also in MZMind so that you can do, for example, molecular networking, not by directly looking at the differences in the spectra using, for example, cosine similarity, but instead by using a machine learning model, which predicts that these two spectra are probably coming from similar molecules, even though the spectra don't necessarily look that similar. But we have a foundation model that was trained on tens or hundreds of millions of spectra. And so now it can tell us something about the spectra even beyond just spectral similarity. And this is now also available in MZMind.
Okay, thanks. Is there anything else you'd like to point out about the software?
I mentioned that we are developing enterprise solution now, and that is available for the industry because the industry doesn't really want to use open source tools for obvious reasons. Yeah. But we also try to keep MZMind really accessible to the academic community. And we see this as a very important aspect because, first of all, it came from the academic world and, you know, we want to make it available for the academic world. But also, this is a way how to potentially attract new features, get some inspiration from the researchers who work in metabolomics and keep engagement within the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you very much. And thank you also for that work and all your colleagues as well who work on this. I think it's really a great contribution. And it helps to have a tool, but it also helps to create the community and make people work together. So I think it has those both aspects in it.
Yeah, and the community actually has grown so much. We are now just organizing MZMind community workshop in Prague. That's going to take place later this month. And yeah, these community meetings have been very popular in the last few years.
And what happens there?
This year is going to be a two-day event where we present the recent developments in MZMime. We give us some tutorials for new users how to use it. And we also have talks from the community, you know, people showcasing their research and how they use MZMime to push their research forward.
Sounds great. I wish you a lot of fun there.
Thanks.
I think it's time to move on to our paper that we wanted to discuss. This year, I want to focus on the podcast on 5P medicine and new ways to do medicine using molecular tools. And I asked you which of your papers you thought was most relevant to that. And you took me to not one of your most recent papers, but one of the more foundational ones for you and your research. The title is The Biosynthetic Origin of Psychoactive Cavalactones in Cava, and you're the first author. So can you tell us a bit what you did in that paper and why it was so important in your career?
Yeah. So I will maybe first say a few words about kava.
Yeah? Yes.
So kava is this plant. It's a small shrub that grows in the Pacific Islands, Polynesia. And over there, it has become like, it's considered a sacred plant. People grow this plant, they collect it, they collect the roots, they dry the roots, and then use the roots to prepare a drink that's also called kava. And this drink is used in that area, in that part of the world. It's used in all the official occasions, weddings, ceremonies, business meetings, kind of official events. And it doesn't actually taste very well, but it has this effect. It kind of calms you down. It gives this pleasant feeling of bonding between people. It makes you a bit happy. It has some psychoactive properties, but it doesn't, it's not addictive, and it doesn't make you high in the sense like the other drugs can do. So nowadays, some people think that kava is potentially a very interesting alternative to alcohol, for example. And so we chose this plant, and the advantage here is that people have already studied this plant for a bit, and they understood what are the active molecules in this plant. And these molecules are called cavalactones. They are small metabolites, polyketides, that are known to bind to certain receptors in human brain. That's how they exercise these effects that I was talking about. And so we looked more into the plant, like from the plant perspective, and the question that we ask is, how does kava do this? How does kava make these molecules? Okay. I have to say that kava is not a particularly easy plant to work with because it has 130 chromosomes. It is sterile. So that means it's nowadays entirely propagated by humans. That's the same with many other crops like bananas, for example. Bananas cannot proliferate by themselves, you know. It's all done through cuttings. And so there are no genetic tools. There is no genome available. It's a non-model plant. So it's not a particularly easy plant to work with. But we have some modern approaches that we can do. The first approach, of course, is metabolomics. So looking at the molecules, what we can detect in the different tissues of the plant, that's one. The second approach that we use is transcriptomics, but it's a little different type of transcriptomics that maybe you are familiar with when you work with human cells, for example. Because when you work with model organisms, you typically sequence the transcriptome, and then you map all the sequencing reads to your reference genome. But in this case, there is no reference genome.
Yeah.
So we have to use the sequencing reads to rebuild the transcriptome from the reads. This is called de novo transcriptomics. And it gives us access to the protein sequences that we can find expressed in the plant. But from a typical transcriptomic experiment on the plant, we can get 300,000, 500,000 protein sequences. So it's a lot. And so we started with a hypothesis how these molecules could be built, like what kind of enzymes should be involved based on the molecular structures. And we started searching for these molecules in the for these enzyme sequences in the transcriptome, finding some candidates and then testing them in the lab. And for that, we use various approaches, either in vitro expression in a test tube or we use model plants like Nicotiana bentamiana, kind of, it's an agrobacterium-mediated expression in this model plant. Or we use microorganisms such as yeast. So there are different approaches. Each of them has its advantages. But in the end, now I'm going to skip like 3 years later. In the end, we found 7 enzymes that are involved in this whole biosynthetic network of cavalectins. And we even solved crystal structures of 3 of these enzymes. So we really understood how these enzymes work, what's the mechanism. Mm-hmm. And we basically made a complete description of this pathway and even did a little bit of engineering of this pathway in microorganisms. So we have a proof of concept that this pathway can be engineered and these molecules can be produced heterologously in other organisms. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, this was really a landmark paper in the sense that it inspired me what I want to do in my career. I'm not necessarily doing the same exactly, but I think this direction is very interesting. It has huge potential for the future. And at the same time, it's very low throughput. It took me 4 years of work to solve this one pathway in one plant. If you imagine how many biosynthetic pathways exist in the plant kingdom, we can never really do this experimentally. And so what I'm trying now to do in my lab is to employ more computational approaches, yeah, how we could do this on a large scale, not on one plant, but on the whole plant kingdom, or at least mm-hmm. like one plant genus or something like that, mm-hmm. using computational methods and approaches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what you described was this multi-omics guided candidate approach, right? Because I saw that in the methods and I wanted to ask you to detail this, but you explained it really well. So now I understand it better than when I read the paper. Thank you. It's really interesting. And it's also showing the power of combining those different omics together. I find it fascinating that you can get back to the genome through the transcriptome. It's really cool. You discussed some of the challenges of the paper, also challenges with the plant itself, I guess, are one. But so the really time-consuming aspect is more after you've done the omics, right? It's more the identifying those enzymes and then checking for them and doing the structure and so on, right? Or
yes, that's right, yeah. So finding the enzymes in the whole mess of the transcriptome, that was what took most of the time, yeah.
What is the strategy that you have after, if we take the example of CAVA? What are people interested in these molecules that could have psychoactive effects? What could they do based on the work that you did there?
I think it should be noted that this research was really basic research. And so we are basically interested in how nature does this.
Yeah.
How does the plant do that? And in that process, we discovered a number of new enzymes. And enzymes are very versatile tools. So it could be that some chemist somewhere needs to develop a molecule for entirely different purpose. You know, maybe that chemist is developing a pesticide or some, you know, completely different molecule. And they need to do a particular type of reaction that's very difficult to do using organic synthesis because, for example, there is some selectivity on the stereocenter or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then they find our paper and they realize, oh, I can use this enzyme to do this reaction because it's a similar scaffold of a molecule or something mm-hmm. like that. Right? So discovering new enzymes is generally useful for applying them to any kind of biosynthesis or organic synthesis in combination with enzymes. And chemists do this all the time. So I would say it's more about the production of the molecules or having the options to produce the molecules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because as you said, so like growing CAVA is a relatively troublesome enterprise, at least if you want to, let's say I'm a pharmaceutical company and I find this molecule really interesting and I want to mass produce it. I mean, I'm not going to start having a greenhouse in my facility. I guess I would rather use microorganisms, for example, to produce it for me. So I guess with that paper, you give the first template of how to do this, of course, would be optimized. And people might want to slightly change the structure also and then try to play with the enzyme for that. But I guess there's huge potential there for this type of applications.
Yeah. But also it should be noted that what we did is not yet ready for application. Like we describe the enzymes, but then actually engineering them into a real production level microorganism that you can employ industrially and it gives you the kind of yield that starts to be economically feasible, it still takes a lot of work. Right? It's a different type of work. Yeah. Yeah. There are some examples in the industry where this has been done and some molecules are produced in this way. But overall, it's still a complicated process. And I hope we see more development in that area. I mean, we could call it synthetic biology, let's say, or metabolic engineering. You know, we see more progress in that area to make it more streamlined. So when somebody discovers new enzymatic pathway, that we would have a more streamlined approach now how to engineer it and turn it into something economically viable. It's not that easy nowadays.
Yeah, I'm sure. That definitely takes a lot more effort. Is there something else you would like to say about that paper that we haven't mentioned yet?
I would like to say that we, of course, tried Kava a number of times during the process. And
it's kind of clear from the way you introduce it.
Yeah, it is really interesting. It really has very pleasant kind of effects and unusual effects, I would say. It's very different vibe you get than from drinking alcohol, for example. And nowadays, in the US, there are hundreds of kava bars where you can go and have a cup of kava. It's very easily available. You can buy it on Amazon. It's very easy to get.
Because you mentioned that it's used in business meetings and in all sorts of like communion meetings where people are together. Like it helps this kind of bonding between people then as well, you think? Or
yes. Yes, absolutely. So, like typically, people don't drink kava by themselves. They drink it in a group. And
Because of stigma like alcohol, but because it's better enjoyed that.
It is better. It is more enjoyable, yes. So, people start and the room is loud and they are chatting and, you know, everybody's active, right? And then after 2 hours of drinking kava, you see that the room is growing quieter and people are calm and just smiling at each other. It's like the vibe changes a lot. Yeah. And that's where I see the main difference from, for example, alcohol. Right? Because when people drink alcohol in a group, they tend to get more loud and...
Yes. But they still manage to have meaningful conversations, or does that also go down a little bit?
I think yes. That's why I said, like, kava doesn't really make you high in the sense that you would lose your clarity of thinking. Yeah.
Okay. And so today I saw you still work on kava a little bit, but you've added more plants to your palette, right? You're working on more species now.
That's true. Yeah. I mentioned we are trying to employ more computational approaches and look at these things for more like high throughput manner. And kava belongs to the pepper family of plants. So one project in my lab is focused on this whole family. So it's a large family. It has 3,000 species. And we're trying to understand the biosynthetic patterns in this whole family in a more data-driven way. So instead of focusing on one plant and one pathway, we do the sequencing on many plants from this family. We do the metabolomics, and then we try to find some interesting patterns in the data that would point us in the direction of which genes are responsible for the biosynthesis of what compounds that we see in the mass spec and so on.
Thanks. It's really interesting. And I'm wondering, so when we had the pre-discussion before the recording, I introduced to you the 5P concept. 5P medicine concept, where we have preventive, predictive, precision medicine, population-based medicine, and participatory medicine. And so, like, knowing this, and also from based on the work that you do, like, where do you see the most resonance with your work from those 5Ps? Where do you see the strongest connection?
Yeah, this question is a little bit tricky for me, because as you heard, you know, I don't really do medicinal applications.
Yes. Yeah,
but it is true that some of the plants that we are studying are medicinal plants, and we are trying to understand, you know, about the biosynthesis of the medicinal compounds. So, in terms of the 5P, population medicine or precision medicine, if any of that is more connected to my work. But I think it is more about giving better access to the diversity of potential molecules that can be used to develop new medicines. And so we don't directly develop medicines in my lab, but we are giving the community access to some potential scaffolds and starting points that can be also then developed into new medicines.
So it's more the new types of drugs that can enter this 5P medicine framework. Yeah. And maybe it's a new generation. So because I think it's an interesting work you do also, where you take very often ancient remedies and then dissect them to understand why they have been so effective. And what we're doing with this, with multiomics in general, and also multiomics applied to medicine, is a bit the same. It's like dissecting the human biology to try and use it better. So in a sense, there are lots of parallels. So maybe what it is really is like a convergence of those two roads towards having better medicine and better drugs and ways to use them in the future.
Yeah, there are definitely parallels. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe in a broader sense for you, I always ask this to my guests. So you're using metabolomics a lot, and I love to see that metabolomics is the first tool you use before you go to the other omics. It's rarely the case in medicine, I have to say, or in medical applications. So it's great to see that in plants it makes sense, at least. Because I think it makes a lot of sense in medical applications too. But so where do you see the biggest impact of metabolomics in the next 5-10 years in your field? Where do you see it going, where it's not yet, but it's on its way there?
In my field, you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's not an easy question, because I see a huge impact of metabolomics already now. Mm-hmm. I can project in 10 years, it's going to be even more, because the technology is developing. So we'll be able to detect more metabolites, separate them better using new techniques of ion mobility or whatever.
Maybe it is that then, like, how does metabolomics need to evolve to be even more powerful in the next 5-10 years?
My personal opinion is better computational tools. I mean, it's a field that's developing. It's a field that's developing very quickly. Yes. But if you think about a typical metabolomics experiment using a plant from the wild or from the greenhouse, we still don't understand much. And there's so much data that we get. So the data is real. We detect real molecules. Mm-hmm. But how much understanding we produce from the data, it's actually very little. And that's where I see the gap, the missing computational tools. Mm-hmm. So my lab is heavily invested into this. I mentioned previously we are developing machine learning models that can help us interpret mass spectra, and we're developing other tools, you know, to connect these mass spectra to the biosynthetic networks that we are studying and so on. Mm-hmm. But there's still a huge gap. Yeah. So I don't really see that much development in the hardware, in the actual mass specs. Of course, there's development every year. We have new models and they're better and better. But I think what really is going to make a big difference is better computational interpretation of the data.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank you. The development that we're trying to get to, what do you think is the biggest hurdle to reach that?
I mean, people say that identification of molecules is the biggest bottleneck in metabolomics, and that's probably still true. It was true 20 years ago. It's still true now, particularly if you're studying non-model species. You know, it's not so much the case if you're studying human plasma, let's say, but if you're studying really some wild species of plants that nobody studied before, identification of the molecules is really a bottleneck.
Yeah.
But the question is, do we really need to identify all the molecules? In my lab, we're trying to push a slightly different approach. We're trying to understand which of the molecules that we detect in the mass spec are worth identifying.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to make predictions about which molecular structures, based on the spectra that we detect, seem like they would be amazingly novel, you know, new structures that nobody has seen before, that are not in databases, that potentially have new bioactivities that nobody has studied before, and so on. So it's slightly different question than identifying all the molecules. It's more about prioritizing and giving a direction to our research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting. Thanks. And this takes us to our final question. You know what it is. What's your favorite metabolite and why?
I have thought about this for a while. And I have to say this is a very difficult question because I have many favorite metabolites and many of them are amazing. And it's hard to pick one champion. Mm-hmm. But in the end, I thought about it and I picked one that's actually highlighted on my lab website. It's a molecule from plants, surprisingly. It's called aconitine. And it comes from a plant species from a family that's called Aconitum. And in English, it's called monk's hood. These are very, very pretty purple flowers that are extremely poisonous. And in the history, they have been used to poison lots of famous people, kings, and so on.
Also in mystery novels as well.
Yeah. Right, yes. And then this active molecule that actually gives this toxicity to the plant is aconitine. Okay. Mm. But that is not the reason why I chose it.
Okay.
Aconitine is a diterpene alkaloid. And if you look at the chemical structure of this molecule, it looks very strange. It has these intermingled rings, you know, it has, because it's an alkaloid, it has nitrogen in there, but it's a diterpene. It is a very strange molecule from chemical perspective. Even though it's not so big, it's about 600 Dalton, but it looks very strange. And this strangeness means that no human chemist has ever been able to synthesize this molecule. And they have been trying. They have been trying last 100 years, and they keep publishing papers about how they were able to synthesize this part and that part and how close they are getting to, you know, putting that whole molecule together. However, to this date, nobody has been able to synthesize this molecule. Mm-hmm. I find this really fascinating because the plant just does it from, you know, a few basic nutrients and a little bit of sunshine and does this amazing chemistry that human chemists with all the tools and catalysts and, you know, equipment that they have cannot reproduce.
That's a great example. Thank you. And thank you also for limiting it to one. I know it was really hard for you. I think we should also mention before we finish that you're organizing the Metabolomics Conference in Prague later this year. So maybe do you want to say a few words about this?
That is true. Yes, I am the local co-organizer together with David Friedecký from Olomouc. Mm-hmm. We are not really organizing the conference because the logistics of the conference is organized by a company and the scientific program is organized by a scientific organizing committee. But we are taking the roles of local representatives of this conference. Mm-hmm. The conference is going to be very well attended. We have much more registrations now than around the same time in previous years. Mm-hmm. So we expect record attendance to the Metabolomics Conference this year. Wow. I should say that Prague is a beautiful city and I highly recommend to visit. And the program of the conference is also going to be fantastic, but also the program apart from the conference, like the conference dinner, is going to be spectacular. I took care of that.
All right. I'm not going to ask more because I want to put you in a difficult situation, but I'm already registered, but that would make me want to register if I was. Thank you very much. Thank you so much for discussing with me and for sharing also the world of plants metabolomics with me, because I'm really not familiar with it. So for me, it was super interesting. And I hope that you could enjoy the discussion as well.
Yes, it has been a pleasure. And thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of The Metabolomist, where we uncovered new ways in which metabolomics and multiomics are driving breakthroughs in 5P medicine, the powerful framework that's shaping the future of healthcare. If you enjoyed this conversation and want to stay updated, subscribe to our newsletter at themetabolomist.com to be the first to know when our next episode drops. Until then, I hope you get to keep exploring the fascinating world of metabolomics.